As kids, we're taught not to say we hate things. Don't say you hate broccoli, say you strongly dislike it, parents advise. Your emotions regarding broccoli are very unlikely to constitute genuine hatred. But what does it mean to hate? Is hate different deep down from anger, fear, or disgust? I'm Gina Kaufman. In today's encore presentation of Central Standard, we investigate the psychological underpinnings of hatred. Later in the hour, we have a conversation with a biographer of Ray Bradbury, most famous for Fahrenheit 451. That's coming up right after this news. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm a little bit stressed out because the audio for the wrong show played just a little while ago, and people might think they're going to hear a show about hatred, but actually we're talking about stress, and actually I'm not that stressed out about it, but sometimes I'm stressed out, and if you're like about 25% of Americans surveyed by NPR earlier this summer, you're probably stressed out a lot of the time, too. That's unfortunate because stress is bad for your health, generally unpleasant, and on top of it all, really unproductive. So joining me this morning to share his thoughts on stress is Bruce Leese, who visits Central Standard every month to talk about issues in psychology. Hi, Bruce.
Hello there. It's great to be here.
Well, Bruce is a psychologist and professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. And Bruce, how are your stress levels this morning?
They are good. They almost weren't. I had to deal with airline reservations and mistakes and stuff like that. So it made me very aware of stress.
How do you measure your own stress? Like, how do people evaluate that? Like, what is it that allows you to tell me that your stress levels are pretty okay right now?
Well, that is a really good question for more reasons than you might guess. It is typical that people don't know at low levels of stress that they feel stressed. They wait until they're so high that they're unmanageable. So, they wait until they can't sleep. They wait until their appetites are messed up. They're depressed. So the key to dealing with stress is absolutely to recognize it nice and early before it's really problematic.
I am so stressed out is like a phrase that people toss around in a pretty cavalier manner these days. Is it because stress is such a prevalent feature of our lives and our culture, or is it that we tend to overstate our own stress levels?
I don't know that we overstate our own stress levels. I sometimes worry that people are stressed about the wrong things.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I hope I'm not revealing too much here, but I'm far more concerned about the number of wars that are going on in this world, and the potential effects of global climate changes and the fighting in Congress, and I think those are real threats. But when I can't cancel a reservation within the 24-hour time I have to cancel it to get my money back, I really don't think that's important, but I could have come in saying I'm so stressed out today.
But we do tend to be stressed out about the most immediate things.
I thought you were going to say inane things.
if the most immediate thing does happen to be a little bit inane, its immediacy can still make it feel big.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Stress is the activation of all of our senses and our central nervous system and in response to any kind of threat or demand that we don't think we can handle. And it's so uncommon that there's real threat out there. And so we tend to get stressed out by things that really are not that threatening.
So before we go any further, how do you define stress?
It is that activation process. I often ask people how they would feel if somebody was aiming a gun at their head, and they say, oh my God, I'd be terrified. But if they don't know somebody's aiming that same gun at their head, they don't feel any terror at all. In fact, they probably are distracted by other things. So you asked where stress comes from. It's the perception of some threat or of some undesired change or failure or loss. It's the perception of it. So anytime a person claims that they are stressed out, it is because they perceive something to be a challenge, a threat.
So is stress an external force acting upon us? Are there some situations that are objective stressors, or is stress an internal state of mind, or maybe some combination of the two?
It's very important to separate the objective causes of stress from the far more subjective causes of stress. Some of the real stress that people face in our world are things like hunger and war. When we send soldiers and airmen and sailors over into war zones and they come back with PTSD, they experienced very real, objective, external stimuli or situations or triggers that really changed their notion of threat. I mean, they have very real reasons to be to feel stressed. And when they come back, the changes that they experience when they get here can also be threatening. Having to readjust to life where the child crying isn't an Iraqi child dying, where the smell of diesel isn't a tank. So objectively speaking, certainly people who face war directly, go to combat, they have very good reason to feel stressed out. Similarly, children who live in adverse circumstances have reason to feel objectively threatened.
What kind of adverse circumstances?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. I should mention here that there is a phenomenon called an ACE score. ACE is A-C-E. And if you've been to a pediatrician...
An ACE is...
Adverse childhood experience. Some brilliant researchers about 10 years ago, maybe even a little more, started to realize that some children looked worse than others. They looked more stressed out. They looked more troubled. They got sick more easily. They got infections more easily. So these researchers started to look into what's causing that, and they came up with a list of at least 10 factors. The ACE score is how a child rates on whether or not they have experienced these adverse events. In fact, as an adult, if you look back on your life, you can remember whether or not you experienced these adverse childhood events or experiences. And if you did, you're more likely to be sick, you're more likely to die younger, you're more likely to have a lot of mental problems. So those adverse childhood experiences include physical or verbal intimidation, just the intimidation itself, physical abuse, sexual abuse, the absence of love in your home, neglect, separation or divorce. We're on number 6, by the way. A parent that gets abused in front of you, alcoholism or drug abuse in your home, parents with mental illness, or one of your parents gets imprisoned. If those things happen to you as a child, if 4 or more happen to you, there's a very good chance that those objective experiences when you are a child, those very real experiences will lead to significant problems in adulthood. So there are pediatricians that won't do an exam without checking in and making sure that those things aren't happening to children. So in times of war or growing up in a warlike environment at home, those are objective external phenomena that make people seriously stressed.
Are there any genetic components to that? Is there like a nature part that goes along with this nurture or lack thereof part?
Absolutely. That's exactly right, Gina. We are all wired in ways that make us vulnerable to various problems. I mean, some people just have gastrointestinal problems when things aren't going right in their world. And some people get depressed, and some people are anxious. So to the extent that our genetic – and some people become drug addicts, alcoholics. To the extent that we're wired without even knowing it or predisposed to having those kinds of problems, we may have one versus the other problem. Heart disease in some families, hypertension in families. So,
what's the difference between stress and some of the words that we lay people tend to kind of use interchangeably with stress? Words like anxiety, worry, tension.
Stress is more of a lay term, or I reflect back in thinking about that very question. I reflect back around 25, 30 years ago, one of my first talks at the University of Kansas Medical Center, one of my first talks to residents and staff was on stress, and I thought, what a goofy topic. This isn't real psychology.
Why did you think that was goofy?
Oh, because the only thing that we thought about when we thought about stress back then was, you know, here come the holidays. Are we going to cook enough? Are our in-laws going to criticize the cleanliness of the house? Back then, we didn't really understand the devastating effects. Some people may have heard of the Holmes and Ray scale, and it was a list of at least 20 different things that were thought to cause stress: death of a spouse, divorce, marital separation, jail term. So I thought it was goofy because it turned out that actually wasn't very sound from a research standpoint. And it seemed to me that back then, 30 years ago, the word stress was really minimizing much more severe conditions like depression and anxiety. Now, probably because of war and sending people off to war and our attention to child abuse and stuff like that, stress is a very serious problem that's a term used to describe, you know, the combination of what happens to people externally and what happens to people then psychologically when they face some of these terrible demands. So anxiety, depression, headaches, insomnia, isolation, avoidance, those things can all be related to real stress, which is exposure to genuinely threatening circumstances. So back then it was more that everyday stress. It was like stress light. But now we know that there are people that are truly suffering because they have faced such adverse circumstances as children or even as adults.
How does this improved research or better understanding of the seriousness of the problem help people? I mean, is there something that someone can leverage to improve their resilience?
Yeah. I mean, it's the amount of research that has now come out in treating very real stress-related disorders is just spectacular. It's exciting to me. It's encouraging to me. There isn't enough intervention going on, either prevention or intervention going on yet. But I'm so relieved that war veterans now, Iraqi war veterans, Afghanistan war veterans, that there's the potential for them to get the treatment they need. I'm sure that it was just as badly needed after Vietnam, and I'm sure that we didn't have services like we do now available. And it used to be that if you grabbed a kid by the arm and yanked the arm really hard to get him away from the candy in the candy aisle, you know, that's just what parents had to do to teach their kids stuff. But now we understand that that creates a potential lifelong problems for a child. So the reason why I call it light, the reason why I am interested in the external causes of stress is because we now know how real those can be and how they can set people up for anxiety and depression and some other mental and physical disorders that you happen to mention.
Nowadays, it's true that you do hear parents saying things to kids, like kids in the midst of a meltdown saying things like, okay, just take a deep breath. Are those kinds of tools, though? I wonder about, like... Really?
Those are terrible.
Talk about it.
Oh, my goodness. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm shocked that you did, and it's perfect, because to the extent that humans learn to tolerate normal levels of discomfort or stress or change, to the extent that humans learn that when they're young, they can handle stress better as adults. So parents who have kids who wildly misbehave, like big temper tantrums in public, to the extent that they try to use logic and reason with them, they're robbing them of the very real stressful consequences of going into timeout.
Huh.
A child who is having a tantrum is declaring, I can't stand this. I can't handle this. This is terrible. This is awful. This is rotten. I can't have that candy before dinner. You're a terrible mom or dad. A parent that enforces rules like no tantrums is a parent that prepares the child for a genuinely stressful world. There's a concept called frustration tolerance in psychology. And to the extent that us humans can tolerate frustration, like the hour and a half it took me to change my reservations on the phone last night, to the extent that we can handle frustration, our frustration tolerance rises, and we are stronger and more able to handle stressors. But parents who over-accommodate their children in the candy aisle of the grocery store and say, now just take a deep breath, are doing their children. The officer who is giving them a speeding ticket is not going to say, now take a deep breath, when they have a big tantrum and start screaming at the officer. It's not the real world.
But just as far as stress management goes, is something like a deep breath when you notice the symptoms of your stress response setting in, is that useful?
If you had a child who witnessed a terrible event, they see their dog hit by a car, and the crying is not manipulative, it's truly despair and sadness and all that stuff that I would experience if my dog was hit by a car, and a parent teaches techniques for tolerating very real pain, that's great. It's not that parents should not say, take a deep breath. It's that they shouldn't say it when their child should learn how to tolerate frustration. Big difference there. So learning techniques like deep breathing, like I guess counting to 10, I hadn't thought about that, but to the extent that we learn to be emotionally intelligent about what we're feeling and we learn how to deal with our emotions, that's all great. But it ain't the time to teach a kid to deep breathe when the kid is doing something wrong like tantruming.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm here with Bruce Leese. We're talking about stress. And Bruce was just talking about your tolerance for frustration and how to build that. I wonder if our listeners have developed their own techniques or their own insights. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about stress. And Bruce, I wonder if there's anything particular about our culture or our time that you think contributes in any way to the way we experience stress as Americans in 2014.
When I think about current culture, I think about changes that have happened, for example, since I was young. And I think about things like sheer number of distractions that occur to people because of technology, the instant gratification that occurs when people, right in the middle of a very important meeting, if you get a flirtatious text from someone you love and care about, I mean, that's an instant distraction. So technology has changed. Things like ordering online, I actually found myself thinking, well, I don't need to drive over to whatever store I was going to go to. I can just order that online and have it come to my house. You know, the expectation that everything will be easy or easier, I wonder what impact that will have on us.
Interesting. So do you think we're maybe setting ourselves up for a kind of impatience and low tolerance for things just being difficult and complicated?
Yeah, there's a development that's going to occur in Lawrence, been proposed, and there's going to be robotic parking. You just have to walk up to the entrance to the parking lot, and I don't know what you do, press a button or something, and your car comes to you. It gets moved around on gurneys or something. But, you know, that expectation it certainly doesn't make us tougher or ready for the challenges of the real world.
The stress response is a physiological process that's part of how humans have evolved. It's the fight or flight response. And I'd first of all like you to walk us through that response to the extent you're able for the average listener. But also talk about, you know, why we have this. It must benefit us in some way, but it doesn't feel like that when it's happening.
Right. And I think what you're asking is, to the extent I can do it, kind of the step by step what happens, and maybe if I can think of any potential genetic underpinnings, I'd be happy to reflect on that. Again, there are triggers or stimuli or circumstances or situations that are more or less challenging to us human beings, getting to a store that we expected to be open and finding it closed, or thinking that we'll be able to go somewhere that we really expect to go and spraining our ankles and having to use crutches. I mean, so the trigger is going to be something that may be occurring outside in the real world, out in the real world or to our bodies. So there's the trigger. And then sometime after that, there's a response. The response could be, I can't stand this. I'm going to get really upset here, or I'll be patient and things will work out. So that response is a thought, an automatic thought. When we're faced with a challenge, like going up to a store that we're expecting to buy something at and seeing it's closed, we're faced with a challenge, and the challenge is met by a thought. And the thought is, you know, I can't stand this anymore. You know, nothing happens right in this town, or, you know, these things never work out for me. It's been a terrible week. This is yet another problem. So the process is something happens. You think good or bad thoughts, productive or unproductive, adaptive or maladaptive, and then you feel something physiologically.
That is so interesting, though, that the thought comes before the feeling. The thought triggers the feeling state.
Yeah, I'll just remind you of my earlier example, which is, you know, Gina, if somebody's aiming a gun at your head, how do you feel? Oh, I'm terrified. Well, what if you don't know they're aiming the gun at your head? Oh, well, I don't feel anything. So without that perception of threat, there's no stress. And so when we stick soldiers in the battlefield, well, when they have to go house to house to find terrorists, it is very real. And the thought is, I could get killed, or, you know, this place could blow up on me, or, you know, all my buddies might get killed any minute. Those are thoughts. If they thought they were going to trick or treat, you know, and they were going to get candy at the door, they would not be at all stressed. So even in the most adverse of circumstances, it's our thoughts that cause us to feel stressed out.
Let's translate that to some experiences people might have in their day-to-day lives. And obviously, soldiers have the kind of experience you're describing in their day-to-day lives. Here in Kansas City, people encounter all kinds of stress in many forms. Maybe they are smaller and the consequences are not necessarily life and death, but something like stress at the office could make someone feel like their financial security is impaired.
Right. A lot of times what people get stressed about is the perception that they can't possibly get everything done, that there's too much to do, that they have too many demands placed on them, between having to run home and take care of whatever, the dog, the kids, the house, but not really being able to get away from work. I mean, there are all of these perceptions that I won't get done what I want to get done. And those are what I would call normal everyday stressors causing normal everyday stress.
What do you recommend to people as far as keeping that in perspective, or not allowing it to tailspin to where the symptoms of stress then compound the problem that caused the stress?
Well, there are some really good therapies. There are good therapies that have been well supported by very good research. They're psychotherapies that are more or less effective for various mental problems. I'm thinking of one in particular that I've mentioned on the show in the past, which is ACT, A-C-T, and that's acceptance and commitment therapy. Acceptance being the key word here. If you are, if your list of to-do list is a mile long, if it's 30 hours long and you're only going to have 8 hours of time today, the smart thing to do is to accept what you can't control. That's your list. And you will be less stressed if you accept that you can't do it all.
So an ambitious voice inside you that says, if I attempt the impossible, I will become closer to it than if I didn't attempt it. That's maybe not a productive voice.
Oh, there are two voices that are unproductive. If I attempt the impossible, I might do it as one. And the other is the opposite. If I don't expect anything good to happen, I won't be disappointed. Again, it's the thinking, or that voice, as you call it, that determines our own happiness. Acceptance and then commitment to meeting healthy goals, that's a good way to deal with stress, acceptance. But Interestingly, when somebody has a very real objective, very serious, severe kind of stressful life event, sometimes they'll avoid going back out and living their lives. And there's another therapy that works well, and that's called prolonged exposure. So if I was in Iraq and, I don't want to leave my house because, you know, my neighborhood reminds me of one of the neighborhoods I saw, and it just brings back all those memories, the help I'd get from a good psychologist, psychotherapist, counselor, the help I'd get might involve prolonged exposure to being back out there, you know.
What might be an analogous situation for someone who hasn't gone to Iraq?
An analogous situation
just
for
a kind of stress that where prolonged therapy or prolonged exposure would be the appropriate therapy.
Oh yeah, real simple. If I people who are single who should be dating because they don't want to be alone for the rest of their lives might be avoiding online dating, avoiding going to places where healthy single people go. So they might retreat and not go out anymore. A good therapy for them would be prolonged exposure where they spend hours and hours and hours on, for example, an online dating site, realizing nothing terrible will happen to them. How's that for one?
That's very helpful. Well, can stress trigger other really serious psychological conditions and events?
Oh, yeah. Sustained, long-standing stress or exposure to stress can cause profound, lifelong problems. Anybody interested should look up adverse childhood experiences, ACE, adverse childhood experiences. And if you just put the word stress in there, if you're doing a search for it on the internet, you'll find that it can result in adverse childhood experiences can result in mental illness and chronic pain and depression and diabetes, lung disease, amazing things, really sad.
Well, when we get back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bruce Lease about stress. What causes it? What to do about it? We'd love your calls too. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to join this conversation. I'm Gina Kaufman in Central Standard. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with psychologist Bruce Lease, who visits us from the University of Kansas Medical Center to talk about stress. It's something that affects all of us to some degree or another at some point or another. And we'd like to know when in your life you were most stressed out, what caused it, and what coping mechanisms got you through it. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again is 816-235-2888. And Bruce, are there things that we can do to generally make ourselves more resilient when stressful situations arise? Are there kind of like behaviors that can buoy us?
Yeah, and that word resilience is an important word because to the extent that we tolerate frustration and stress well, we are resilient. I try to maintain, though not always successfully, a certain amount of balance in my life so that for as much as I work or as hard as I work or as many hours as I work, I clearly have things that I do that aren't even necessarily outside of my profession, but things I do that I love to do that make me happy. So balance, supportive relationships are extremely important. I think that probably the people who feel the most stressed also experience a lot of isolation, a lack of support from others. It's kind of a vicious cycle. If you feel bad, you don't want to be around people. And if you're not around people, you feel bad. So having healthy, supportive, nurturing, even sometimes advisory relationships where people are willing to tell you what they think, that can be really helpful.
That's interesting because it brings up another question of say that you are a person with a friend or relative who's experiencing a lot of stress and you'd like to be helpful. How can you be that supportive person who's part of that supportive relationship?
that's a tough one because there are so many things that don't work. Maybe I could give you more of the things that don't work.
Yeah.
Well, shallow, superficial answers like this will pass, or don't worry about it, or you need to just get up and put on some makeup in your, or put on your, you know, your big boy pants, or
pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
All of the superficial things.
I think the people who say those things do not believe that they're superficial. I mean, I agree with you that they are, but what is it that what is it that's superficial about that? What is it that people are misunderstanding?
Well, here's what happens. Somebody who's experiencing stress, who tries to tell somebody else who isn't experiencing stress that they're stressed, causes or contributes to the stress of the person that wasn't stressed, and their answer ends up being a stressed answer. It's just an off-the-cuff kind of automatic, uh-oh, what do I say here kind of response. So if I come in, you know, if I come into the studio and I go, you know, Gina, my life is really terrible. You know, it's been an awful day. You may have been feeling good when I came in, but you're feeling stressed now, and there's a chance when we're stressed, we don't focus, concentrate. We're not as sharp as we could be. So some of those answers that we give that are superficial, we don't realize they're superficial because they are, because we're stressed.
It's our own coping mechanism to sort of shut down an uncomfortable conversation.
Exactly. Well said. That's exactly what happens. So what you asked what you can do.
Yeah.
You can always ask questions. Questions are always the best way to get to somebody's heart and soul. Like good questions are for somebody who's stressed, what are you afraid of? Or, you know, what are your resources for dealing with that? Or I can remember a time when you faced worse and you did well. What were you doing then? Or to do well. Or
to say something kind of affirming, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, and this sounds really severe, but when I've had people describe suicidal thoughts to me, I ask them the question, you know, why haven't you committed suicide? What are you still living for? What are the things that really are matter to you? And they may say my children. They may say, you know, I wouldn't want to hurt some of the people who care about me. So drawing out from people what they think is always a good way to help people who are emotionally distressed.
There sometimes maybe when people are trying to move from the thing that stresses them out to something more uplifting or just that they connect to in a more positive way, it's finding that off switch. Do you have are there techniques for finding the off switch that can turn off the valve on the worry and open up the valve toward these other things?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way, and that does cause me to think about why people feel and remain feeling stressed. From their perception, their perception is they have a problem. I'm stressed because I perceive myself to have a problem. That threat is a problem. To the extent that we switch too quick to no, life is beautiful, the problem doesn't get solved. So maybe the switch to help somebody from, you know, one school of thinking calls that a stuck point. There's a cognitive therapy that helps people look at stuck points. Where are you stuck? And rather than just shifting over from sad thoughts to happy thoughts, a solution might be more of what's getting in your way? What's keeping you right now from being happier? What's keeping you right now from solving this problem? So a happy thought doesn't solve a problem.
Well, let's turn to Katrina in Waldo. Hi, Katrina.
Hi there.
What can you share with us?
Well, I am a single woman and I live in Waldo. And several years ago, we had about a 6-month period where there was a Waldo rapist at large. And that was an absolutely terrifying experience for me. It was really 24/7 terror. And after that period, I started to experience depression, although I didn't know that's what it was. But my doctor later helped me understand that it was depression, and I've dealt with it since then. And I had the thought that perhaps the fight or flight adrenaline increase in my brain chemistry would cause the depression, but I sure haven't figured out a way to reverse that.
Bruce, is there anything that you can share about sort of, I don't know, situations like a rapist at large that affect large numbers of people that aren't coming from within you or within your personal life necessarily?
Absolutely. We talked earlier in the show about, I don't know if I use the word identity, but I certainly use the words threat and vulnerability. And Katrina, you certainly perceived yourself prior to a rapist being in Waldo. You perceived yourself, your identity as being, you know, just a person who's lives in a nice neighborhood where you'd be safe and there'd be no real threats to your vulnerability, especially life-threatening threats or sexual assault threats. So you're going along in life thinking, I'm a safe person. I don't live in a dangerous, terrible world. And then all of a sudden that belief is pretty much destroyed by the fact, the real true belief that there is somebody dangerous out there who might prey on me. So the shift from an identity of I'm a safe person to I'm a person at high risk is enough if it's prolonged and the problem isn't resolved by the rapist being caught, it makes perfect sense that brain chemistry would change. I don't know that it's a fight or flight thing. I just think I believe pretty strongly, actually, I believe completely that we're just, you know, bags of biochemical processes walking around. And I think that brain and body chemistry and hormones and all that, they all function differently when we're under threat. And if it's chronic, it shouldn't surprise anyone that can turn into a disorder. It can be depression. It can be PTSD. It can be generalized anxiety. So Katrina's description of how she got what was essentially a depression makes good sense. The brain chemistry changes when we continually believe that we are under siege.
Katrina, thank you so much for sharing that story with us, and good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
And we do have some other callers, but I want to follow up on one other thing you said, Bruce. You talked about not only a change in actual safety, but also in identity.
Sense of self.
Yeah, and
sense of
this
self,
idea
yeah.
that maybe you think of your home in one way before an incident like this, where my home is a refuge, my home is a place from which I derive enjoyment and solace, to my home is a place where I am threatened. How do these identity things figure into stress?
Oh, hugely. Today, as I was thinking about the show, driving here, my 60-mile, 50-mile drive, I'm driving down the highway and a police car is screaming up to me on I-70 with lights and everything flashing. And apparently there was a wreck further on. So off he goes when I change lanes and I see it's a... But as he pulled up to me, I started to feel symptoms of stress. I thought, uh-oh. Now, that was the first thought, uh-oh. Following that and discovering my palms were sweating on my steering wheel, I started to think about the show and about questions like that. And, you know, my sense of myself is that I'm a law-abiding citizen, that I won't ever need police to tell me how to behave because I'll probably be too well behaved. So suddenly, why did I get so stressed? Because my identity was threatened. You know, pre-officer pulling up behind me, I thought I'm a law-abiding guy that, you know, tries not to do anything wrong. When I saw the lights, it's like, uh-oh, you know, I'm
on trial.
My identity is about to change. I'm an offender now. You know, I'm a speeder or something.
We have a couple of emails that I'd like you to respond to. One is Donnie writes, in researching my 75-year-old mother's condition, he found that normal brain shrinkage, as she was diagnosed with, he also ran across information that asserted that stress in your life prior to old age contributes to dementia and memory issues in old age. Is that true?
I am about to look on my list to see if it's one of the research findings. I don't doubt it, but I haven't. What I have listed in front of me is just the things that have been found in the research to be caused by stress and stressors and all that stuff. And there's a lot on here, too many to read. Suicide and early death and all that, violence and vocational instability. There's so many things, diabetes, so many things on the list, but I don't see dementia here.
All right. And Ian writes in that sometimes people try to use stress relievers such as video games or reading that never actually get at the underlying issue. Is there something to be said for distractions, or are these just that, distractions?
Solve the problem is the first thing that pops into my head. Use the alarm that's going off in your head to solve a problem. More often than not, oh my goodness, more often than not, people's problems are exacerbated by distractions that have become chronic distractions. So, you know, vacations are a great example of where escapism is good. You know, going out for a run or a walk or going for a swim, doing healthy things is the best distraction, as long as it's not interfering with solving problems.
Let's talk to Aaron in Lenexa. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I was just going to make a comment about the stress relievers earlier. So a couple years ago, my stepdad left my mom after 15 years, and obviously we were just crushed. And I found that the best way to relieve my stress was to do everything I possibly could to make my mom happy.
So your mom was another person who had experienced in a different way what you were also going through.
Yeah. So obviously it hurt us both, but the best way for me to deal with it was to help her deal with it. And I didn't know if the doctor had any comments about that.
Thanks, Aaron. That's a good example of a kind of real life everyday stressor that people face, especially as the population grows older. You know, it's all about balance, Aaron. It's all about knowing how much we should try to lift somebody up who's been through difficult times and how much we should encourage them to lift themselves up. So I won't make any assumptions about whether your response to her was well balanced, but I know people who, under circumstances like yours, even if it's an illness, then really don't allow the person to take control and responsibility for their own repair, their own improvement. You know, if you balanced, you know, having dinner with her more, if on the supportive side, you know, had dinner with her often, and you came and did her lawn, you know, mowed her lawn, and helped her with, you know, shopping. If you did all that stuff, but also said, "Come on, Mom, you know, what's done is done. You got to pick yourself up and move on." And you know, I want to know what you're doing for yourself. If you did both, then that's balanced, and that would be good for her.
But what about this idea that helping her helped him cope with what he was feeling?
That's why people make the mistake of over-functioning. And Aaron, we're not claiming this is you, but to some extent, people rescue other people or they over-function for those other people as a stress reducer themselves. And I can't tell you how many thousands of times I've heard people say, you know, I do so much for everybody and people don't do anything for me, or, you know, if you're doing so much for everybody and nobody's doing nothing for you, it's time to quit doing for everybody and start doing for you. So, again, Aaron, I think what you did is wonderful, but it has to be balanced or people will not. They won't be effective. I like to think that people at 75 and 85 and 95 are still responsible for their own well-being, because I hope to be there someday, and I hope people hold me responsible for my choices.
Let's talk to Craig and Lawrence. Hi, Craig.
Hello. I, too, am a warrior on stress. I'm a licensed massage therapist for well-seasoned for 6 years. And it seems like massage therapy always seems to get skipped or overlooked on decreasing any kind of stress level as far as serotonin is concerned, and decreasing that and increasing the serotonin levels or increasing the endorphins, which decreases the stress itself. And it always seems to resort to prescriptions. And,
well, but Craig, it
just blows me away.
Yeah,
how, that gets overlooked. It's more than just the psychological; it's physical as well.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I was also curious about this idea that people talk about people, certain individuals, holding stress in specific physical places, like holding tension in your shoulders or something. Could you tease out some of this physical, mental, mind, body stuff for us?
Oh, I can do that, and also address the specific question of therapy, whether it's massage therapy, psychotherapy, play therapy, any of those therapies. I teach psychotherapy at KU in Lawrence, besides teaching at the medical school. And so I have to be on top of all the research on what therapies do and don't work. There's a phenomenon in all therapies called common factors. They are factors. They are things that happen in all kinds of therapies. They involve a relationship. So Craig has a relationship with his clients. They involve empathy. I'm sure Craig is empathetic with his clients. They involve, kind of leaving the everyday world to do something that's special and just for oneself. So there are common factors across treatments, therapeutic treatments, physicians, podiatrists, physiatrists, massage therapists, psychologists. There are factors. There are things that a good therapist does that are good for people. And just so Craig knows that I don't leave out massage therapists, at an earlier time in my wife's life, she was a massage therapist, licensed massage therapist, and she would often tell me about the impacts of massage therapy to her clients, and they were real and they were good. So, Craig, I won't leave that out. But there are still those common factors that are so important when people take care of each other, compassion and empathy and touch.
And what about this thing, though, that there are physical responses in our body to stress, and so that's your mind creating a physical reaction. Is undoing that physical condition, like tightness in a certain area, does it work both ways? Can that affect the mental state?
You asked earlier about people's predisposition to getting anxious and depressed, and you didn't say headaches, but sleep problems and all that stuff. Just like we're all predisposed to different ailments and different difficulties and challenges and problems, we're all predisposed to the kind of treatment that will help us. Not everyone. My wife was a massage therapist, and I don't find for me that my body, if she rubs my back or shoulders or whatever, it feels loving, but I don't get a therapeutic impact. And I know a lot of people do. So we're kind of born with vulnerabilities, but we're also born with to a certain degree, and we grow up learning to appreciate different kinds of therapeutics. Some people are fortunate in that they're wired to do exercise when they're stressed out, and that gets them unstressed. So sure, massage therapy works. Sure, body impacts are well treated by physical therapies, but not for everyone, just like not everyone gets anxious or depressed.
Let's hear from Gabriella in Kansas City. Hi, Gabriella.
I am Gabrielle.
Go on. Thank you.
Well, we adopted two kids from Poland in 2011. They have reactive attachment disorder based on those ACEs that your guest talked about earlier. And my son's exhibits through violence, and he was even violent yesterday, and it definitely affects my stress level and depression based on, living under siege with an abusive child.
So that is a really interesting set of circumstances, and thank you so much, Gabrielle, for sharing that.
You Bruce, said unusual, didn't you? You want to hear, in this last month, I've worked with, I think, four people who have adopted children from other cultures and discovered the same thing that Gabrielle has discovered.
So not so unusual.
It certainly is something that is presented to mental health care workers like myself. And it is very difficult. And the reactive attachment disorder makes a lot of sense, because who knows how many adverse adverse childhood events or experiences.
What is reactive attachment disorder?
Well, an attachment disorder, I'm glad you asked me that question, because that's one of my strongest areas of interest and research is attachment and attachment disorders. Little children turn to the adults that are supposed to care for them when things are going wrong, when they're hungry, when their diapers are wet, when they fall and scrape their knee, they turn to the people who are supposed to take care of them for nurturing, for a Band-Aid, for care. If the care is non-existent, if they turn to an adult or a caretaker and it's non-existent, or even worse, if they get knocked around for crying, instead of getting the Band-Aid, they get slapped and pushed out the door, saying that's nothing, they are unable to attach to others. And in adulthood, they don't develop close attached relationships. Well, Gabrielle said that it was reactive attachment disorder, which may very well mean that it's not just they don't attach, but they're very reactive to their environment. They get angry easy, hurt easily, etc. You know, this is a situation where the entire family must get treatment together. The children need attention by a competent caregiver, professional caregiver, and so does Gabrielle, so does the rest of the family, because the, again, I use the word impacts, the impacts on the whole family can be devastating. And responding, taking care of oneself and taking care of children who are troubled is, I mean, you've got to balance and have both. So that's a severe problem, and I hope that Gabrielle gets good help.
And thank you so much again, Gabrielle, for calling and sharing that with us. There are so many things we've talked about today that set us up for stress. What is it that we can do to kind of take matters into our own hands more? Is it just decided for us that if we've experienced some of these things, we're going to be prone to this kind of troubling situation?
I think that, to me, as a cognitive psychologist, cognitive therapist, I would always push people towards looking at how they're thinking about things and encourage people to think, I can accept this or I can do something about it and I can fix it. And then I'll always argue for healthy habits and a healthy lifestyle.
That's all the time we have for today's show. As always, Bruce, it's been an enlightening and informative hour. I've enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Bruce Leese is a psychologist and professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. To listen back to today's show or any past conversations, just go online to kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll be chatting with Kansas City's own V-Tran. The Vietnamese-American singer-songwriter is now performing a one-man show all about his family's story. We'll spend some time getting to know him tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help today from Matt Hodep and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.